Good evening. My name is Doug Chin, and I'm president of the Cornell Bible Research Group, and I want to welcome you to this spring's meeting of the group. The basic purpose of our group is to do things connected with biblical research, and one of the things that we try to do is to provide, let's say, events or different sorts of information that is not generally available to people who are taking courses that are connected with the Bible. And tonight we have arranged a debate on the subject, are the biblical accounts of Easter week trustworthy? In case all of you don't know what today is, it's Friday the 13th, and furthermore, it happens to be Good Friday as well. And so every year at this time, people have, let's say, debated back and forth, what does Easter mean? Is it really a celebration of historical events of the death and resurrection of Jesus, or have the biblical accounts been misunderstood in some way so that the traditions we go through now have been unjustly extrapolated from the biblical material? So that's what tonight's debate is about. Now, essentially, the way we're going to run this is that we'll have an affirmative talk and a negative talk, and they will be given each a half an hour. There's a timer here with a buzzer, and when the speaker comes up, I will turn the timer on, and after it buzzes 30 minutes later, I will try to politely cut the guy off, if that's necessary. Okay. So after the two talks, then I'm going to call a 10-minute break. So I'll put the timer on, and when the buzzer goes off again, hopefully you'll all be back here. Followed after that, we'll have two summary talks where each person will be able to have 10 minutes to discuss the other person's longer presentation. Following that, we'll have a question and answer session where we'll have general questions from the audience. You can each ask a question to a particular person, and then the other person, after he answers, the other person will get a chance to comment on the first answer. And so when I ascertain that perhaps the questions are dragging too long, then I'll try to cut that off. And then each person will be given a five minutes at the end to summarize what they would like. So that's the way our debate's going to run tonight. So on the affirmative side, tonight we have a Dr. Robert Newman. He's a professor at Biblical School of Theology. He graduated here from Cornell in 68 from Master Physics, and then he went on to seminary at Biblical School of Theology, where he graduated from there and now is a professor there. On the negative side, we have Professor Robert Hall. He's a professor emeritus now. He was here at Cornell teaching linguistics and Italian, and he's the author of 40 books or so. And last year at this time, he put out an article that, let's say, provoked some controversy in the Ithaca Journal, where the Ithaca Journal, let's say, as he tells me, flashed his title up saying, are the finding myths and facts in Easter? And so we have these two here tonight to discuss this question, are the biblical accounts of Easter week trustworthy? And so, without any further introductions from me, we'll have Dr. Newman give his talk.
I wrote a paper for this presentation and read it over as fast as I could after I finished the paper and ran out 47 minutes. So I've been fiddling around trying to get it down to 30 minutes. I think I've come pretty close, but you'll have to understand that I'm not going to be able to look around the audience genially and give gestures and things like that. I'll be staring at the paper as hard as I can, trying to see the words fly by. So if you will give me that indulgence, we will begin. We are gathered here this evening to consider the question, are the biblical accounts of Easter week trustworthy? I'm convinced that they are. In fact, I've given up a career in astrophysics and turned to theology because I believe these accounts are reliable. Of course, many people have even given up their lives for mistaken causes, so the strength of a person's believing is by itself no real measure of the truth of his beliefs. Here, however, it is not a matter of belief as a blind leap in the dark. On the contrary, belief in the reliability of the gospel narratives is based on excellent evidence, especially for the events surrounding the death and resurrection of Jesus in Nazareth. There is a belief, a solid evidence for the reliability of these accounts, as for any accounts that come to us from the ancient world. At the outset, it must be admitted that many modern men, especially in academic circles, find it hard to believe that these accounts are reliable. The problem they have is not hard to find. It is the presence of miracle. In the events of Easter week, the miracle preeminently involved is the resurrection of Jesus. Ever since the 18th century, there has been a strong tendency to discount any narrative which purports to describe supernatural phenomena. Since the Gospels report many such phenomena, it is only natural that those who reject the miraculous should find the Gospels untrustworthy. I agree with them. If miracles do not happen, the Gospel accounts are not trustworthy. If miracles do not happen, then the resurrection of Jesus did not happen. Indeed, it would be foolish to call the narratives of Easter week trustworthy if the one central event of their narration is a myth, a legend, a delusion, a fraud, or a lie. Why do so many modern men reject the reality of miracles? Probably the classic argument against miracles is that of the philosopher David Hume, first published in 1748. Briefly sketched, his argument runs as follows. Experience is our only guide concerning matters of fact. Since we cannot see connections between events, all inferences of such connection are based merely upon our observation that these events constantly recur in conjunction with one another. Likewise, our belief in the reliability of human testimony is derived from the usual agreement between facts and the reports of witnesses. But if human testimony reports an extraordinary or marvelous event, then the weight of this testimony is reduced in proportion to the degree to which the event is unusual. Now, a miracle, by definition, is a violation of the laws of nature. But the laws of nature are established by firm and unalterable experience, so that a miracle goes against the very evidence by which we determine matters of fact. In conclusion, no human testimony is sufficient to establish the occurrence of a miracle unless the testimony is of such a kind that its being false would be more miraculous than the fact it seeks to establish. For Hume, this argument leads to the following methodology. When anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or that the fact which he relates should actually have happened. I weigh the one miracle against the other, and according to superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision and always reject the greater miracle. As I see it, there are at least three serious problems with Hume's argument. First, Hume's definition of miracle is questionable. In Orthodox Christianity, a miracle is an action produced by a spiritual intelligence, usually God, Satan, an angel, or demon, intervening in the natural world to produce a result which would not otherwise have happened. In principle, a miracle need no more violate natural law than I do when I intervene in the natural world to pick up this pen, causing it to rise from the desk, an event which certainly would not have happened without my intervention. We thus have in human volition a simple analogy for a miracle which does not violate natural law. If God or other spiritual beings exist, there's no obvious reason why they might not intervene in such a way. Second, Hume claims that natural law is established by firm and unalterable experience. Admittedly, something we call natural law exists, and there are some real advantages to discovering and using these laws, as our modern technology attests. But in saying these laws are established by unalterable experience, Hume goes far beyond anything the empirical method can establish. At most, this method can only list all events which actually have happened, not those which are able to happen, though in fact they have not. Actually, however, natural laws are not even based on a complete induction of what has happened, but only on a small subset which is limited both in time and space. Within the subset of events known to mankind are many reports of the miraculous. So even if we define miracle as a violation of natural law, we only know that natural law is established by firm experience if, in fact, all these reports of miracles are actually false. This we do not know unless we have investigated each report and found it to be false, which no one has done, or unless we have begged the question by importing a conclusion into our premises. In fact, Hume's argument is really methodology in disguise. In explaining events, Hume tells us to adopt any other explanation rather than the miraculous. But wait, do me the favor, please, to suppose for a moment that miracles really do occur. Now, using Hume's methodology, you will still never recognize a miracle, for it may always be assumed more likely that the testimony of any number of witnesses, indeed of one's own senses, is false, since witnesses can lie, and since our senses can be deceived. Hume's methodology will thus explain away the miraculous, even given that it does occur. He is therefore neither an argument against, nor even a real test for the occurrence of the miraculous. There are other arguments against the miraculous. Let us look at two more. The theologian Rudolf Bultmann claims that science sees the universe and history as closed systems of cause and effect, which cannot be perforated by supernatural powers. But is the universe or history actually a closed system of cause and effect? Certainly we have evidence for the existence of cause and effect in the universe. Likewise, there's reason to believe that this universe is a system, in that the same physical laws which operate on Earth seem to be operating in distant stars and galaxies. But is it a closed system in which there can be no external influences? Two lines of evidence indicate that this assumption is unproved or suggested as even unlikely. First of all, the discoveries in this century regarding microscopic phenomena suggest that epistemologically, at small sizes, we reach a floor, so to speak, that because of the problems of light and its quantization, we cannot observe beyond certain size scales without using energies big enough to disrupt whatever was there in the first place. And therefore, we do not know that the universe is closed on the microscopic scale. Secondly, on the large scale end of cosmology, as we look at the universe, the best explanation that has been proposed for its development is an explanation known as the Big Bang Theory. This theory looks back to an explosion some billions of years ago from which the present universe developed. And there again, it is impossible to tell what happened before this explosion. And therefore, the universe seems to be open in regard to knowing that it's a closed system in its early history as well. Thus, the claim that the universe or history is a closed system of cause and effect is an assumption which may or may not be true. If we allow this assumption to control our investigations, it may very well keep us from reaching the correct answer. The church historian Adolf Harnack has argued that miracles were believed in ancient times because people were scientifically ignorant, whereas today we know better than to believe such things. He says, "In those days, the strict conception which we attach to the word miracle was as yet unknown. It came in only with the knowledge of the laws of nature and their general validity. Before that, no sound insight existed into what was possible and what was impossible, what was rule and what was exception." With all due respect to Professor Harnack, I find this argument incredible. It is true that many ancients thought lightning, meteors, and comets supernatural. But many today also think certain psychic phenomena are supernatural. Yet the ancients nonetheless had a pretty good idea of what was natural and what was supernatural, just as the average person does today. And anyone can see this by looking at the kinds of miracles reported in ancient accounts. But what of biblical miracles? Have scientists been able to show that Jesus' miracles as described in the Gospels may be produced naturally? Do we find the Gospel crowds gaping at what are obviously natural phenomena or at Jesus' performance of tricks in a repertoire known to modern stage magicians? No. Even liberal theologians have laughed to scorn the absurd attempts to see Jesus walking on water as really on a sandbar, his feeding the 5,000 as getting them to share their own lunches, and his ascension as walking up the hillside in the clouds. We certainly have our share of 20th century chauvinism if we imagine the ancients were such fools as this. Other arguments have been raised against miracle, but we have had time here only to touch on a few of them to show that such arguments are not as strong as they may first appear. Indeed, there is a tendency among them to beg the question or overstate the case to such an extent as to invalidate the argument. This being so, we should not go into an examination of the New Testament accounts with a presumption against the miraculous. But setting aside such a presumption, we shall see that their reliability looks very good indeed. The biblical accounts of Easter week are found principally in the canonical Gospels according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which primarily narrate the public career of Jesus of Nazareth. Incidental notices also occur in the letters of Paul to various churches, principally 1 Corinthians. In considering the character of these materials, let us compare them with the major historical writings from the same period and with the earlier Greek histories. From roughly the same period as the New Testament, we have the works of Jewish historian Josephus, the two most important being his Antiquities of the Jews, narrating events from creation to the outbreak of the Jewish revolt against Rome in AD 66, and his Jewish War, describing the result itself and two centuries of background leading up to it. A contemporary Greek historian is Plutarch, author of some 46 parallel lives of famous Greeks and Romans. Among Roman historians, most important are Tacitus, whose annals describe the history of Rome from Tiberius to Nero, and Suetonius, whose lives of 12 Caesars include the careers of the emperors from Julius Caesar to Domitian. The major earlier Greek histories are the history of Herodotus, describing the rise of the Persian Empire and its wars with Greece, the history of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, the Anabasis of Xenophon, relating the retreat of 1,000 Greek mercenaries across Asia Minor, and the history of Polybius, describing the rise of Rome. The first question we need to consider is the reliability of the text of the biblical accounts. Unlike the situation today, where an author can check his work in page proofs and then have thousands of identical copies run off on printing press, the ancient author was faced with the problem that each copy was made individually, and for manuscripts of any length, new errors were bound to arise in each copy. In addition, the passage of nearly 2,000 years and the intervention of Dark Ages have resulted in the loss of the vast majority of copies actually made for any ancient published work. How does the New Testament compare in this with other ancient works? The earliest complete manuscripts, the Gospels and Pauline letters, which have survived, date back to the middle of the 4th century, when more durable parchment was adopted in place of fragile papyrus as writing material. Papyrus fragments, which are more or less papyrus manuscripts, which are more or less fragmentary, however, have survived from an early period, dating back to about 225 for Mark, 200 for Matthew, Luke, and 1 Corinthians, and 135 for John. The total manuscript evidence in the New Testament up to the age of printing consists of more than 15,000 copies in Greek, Latin, and other ancient languages. By contrast, the earliest substantial manuscripts for our other ancient historians come from the 9th century. The best case is that of Suetonius, for which the first good surviving manuscript comes more than 700 years after the book left its author's hands. The worst case among these is Xenophon's Anabasis, where the earliest good manuscript comes from the 14th century, over 1,700 years after the book was written. Three of these historians are not even preserved in their entirety. First few chapters of Suetonius are lost, so are four of Tacitus' 16 books, and two others lost in part. For Polybius, we have only five complete books out of 40, though condensed versions of others have survived. The entire manuscript evidence of these 10 ancient historians totals about 200 manuscripts. Thus, the best attested of these secular historians is known by manuscripts more than twice as far removed from its author as are the New Testament documents. The total documentary evidence for these histories is thousands of times smaller in the worst case and more than 50 times smaller for the whole lot put together. In fact, the New Testament survives in more manuscripts than any other work of classical history. The runner-up is Homer's Iliad, which survives in about 650 manuscripts, less than 1/20 as many. How certain can we be that we have the best text we can put together from surviving manuscripts? Closely approximate what the authors actually wrote? Without the actual manuscripts written or proofed by the author, there will always be a possibility of error here. However, the science of textual criticism was especially developed to deal with this problem in works written before the advent of printing. What does it say about this? Professor Hort of Cambridge, in his classic work on the New Testament text, notes that 7/8 of its text is accepted by all as being preserved as penned by its original authors. The remaining 1/8 consists largely of matters of spelling and word order, both of which were relatively trivial in ancient Greek. If scholars are correct in their consensus that the Alexandrian family of manuscripts preserves the best text, this area of doubt reduces to about 1/60 of the text, of which Hort estimates substantial variants total only about 1/1000 of the text. Detailed statistics on the classical texts are hard to come by, but recall that three of our 10 secular histories have not even been preserved over substantial portions of the text. For Homer's Iliad, 750 to 1,000 lines are in dispute out of a total of 15,600. This gives a percentage of doubtful material in the range of 5 to 6.5%. For the New Testament, Hort's estimate of substantial variation would be 0.1%, and even his figure including trivial variation is less than 2%. Of course, one may concede that the text of the New Testament is good, that is substantially as written by its original authors, and still claim that its historical content is untrustworthy. This is regularly done in liberal theological circles, where a general rejection of the miraculous requires that the Gospels be unreliable. Such persons, therefore, make a strenuous attempt to deny that the Gospels were written by the traditional authors or depend upon eyewitness testimony. The methodology employed for this denial, however, is sufficient to explain away any of the ancient historians as well. Let us see. Admittedly, the Gospel narratives are anonymous in their text, in that none of them says, "I, Matthew, wrote this," or something of the sort. The reason for this is not certain, but probably is intended to emphasize the subject, Jesus, by de-emphasizing the author. Even so, for the Gospel of Luke, the author's prologue indicates that he is known to its recipient, Theophilus. Likewise, for John's Gospel, the author is known to some group which vouches for him in the last chapter. Thus, at least two of the Gospels were not anonymous to their first recipients. In the light of this, it is significant that early Christian tradition is unanimous in assigning the canonical Gospels to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and that the earliest surviving papyri have titles also, all of which give the traditional authors only. This is most naturally explained if indeed these men were the authors and it was common knowledge in the early church. Otherwise, one must explain the complete loss of the correct information and its complete replacement by a single set of spurious names, a set, moreover, in which the assignment of authorship to two rather obscure persons like Mark and Luke is most surprising. One would have thought that for invented names, any apostle would be more likely choice than Mark and Luke, and any of the major apostles more likely than Matthew. Other external evidence for the authorship of the four Gospels is as follows. Papias, church leader in Asia Minor and an old man by AD 130, names Matthew and Mark as Gospel writers, indicating that Matthew wrote in Hebrew, Aramaic, or Hebrew style, and describing Mark as one who recorded Peter's reminiscences. Papias apparently himself was a student of the Apostle John. Justin Martyr, after studying many of the contemporary philosophies, converted to Christianity somewhere before 130 AD. He speaks of the Gospels as memoirs of the apostles, says that they were written by apostles and those who followed them, exactly matching the traditional ascription to two apostles and two followers. He quotes from or mentions matters found in each of the four Gospels and apparently alludes to Mark's Gospel as Peter's memoirs. From late in the second century, we have the Muratorian canon from Italy, Irenaeus from France and Asia Minor, and Clement and Origen from Alexandria. And all of these give the traditional authors. None of these men give any indication that they are guessing, innovating, or borrowing from one another. all this suggests that the information was common knowledge from the previous generation. Internal evidence in the Gospel supports these identifications. Matthew is obviously written for those of Jewish background, with its emphasis on Jesus the Messiah fulfilling Old Testament prophecy and its presentation of Jewish customs without explanation. Mark's Gospel fits the vividness and brusqueness of Peter's personality. The incident reports of a young man who loses his clothing to the mob arresting Jesus makes good sense if it is a little touch from Mark's personal history, but it's quite puzzling otherwise. Paul tells us that Luke is a Gentile physician. Luke's Gospel shows special interest in the Gentiles and abounds in technical medical terminology. John is the only apostle who calls John the Baptist merely John, for the apostle John is never named in that Gospel. Its author claims, however, to have been beside Jesus' last supper and crucifixion, to have raised Peter to the empty tomb, and to have seen and heard the resurrected Jesus on several occasions. Of course, it is possible to claim that some early Christians faked these details, and that other Christians noticed the details and unanimously agreed in guessing who wrote each one. But this methodology will explain away any historical data. That the Apostle Paul wrote 1 Corinthians is as certain as that he existed. Not only does the letter claim to have been written by Paul, but the earliest extra-biblical Christian writing still in existence affirms it. Clement's letter to the Corinthians, written about AD 95, quotes from it, names it, describes it, and assigns it to the Apostle Paul. All this occurs within 30 years of the Apostle's death in a writing by the leader of the church at Rome, where Paul had labored and given up his life for the faith. To the best of my knowledge, none of the 10 classical histories we have been considering has any such external attestation as 1 Corinthians or even as the Gospels. I have not been able to find any statement by ancient writers concerning the authorship or circumstances of their composition as we have for the Gospels. Admittedly, I'm only an amateur in the study of secular classical literature, but the very fact that such things are not discussed in the Oxford Classical Dictionary, Harper's Dictionary of Classical Literature and Antiquities, and the relevant volumes of the Lloyd Classical Library show how little modern historians studying the classical period share the skepticism so common to liberal New Testament studies. It seems to me, then, that the burden of proof is on those who deny traditional authorship to come forward with some substantial evidence to support their speculations. Taking in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Paul as authors of these works, how do they stack up against other history writers of antiquity? What qualifications would we expect in a history writer? It is especially advantageous for him to be an eyewitness to the events he's to narrate. This is not always possible, but it's certainly important that he have access to eyewitness testimony. It is nice for him to be unbiased, but more important for him to be sufficiently interested in the subject to write. We would have little history writing if we had to depend upon unbiased reporters. It is helpful if we can test the historian's statements by corroboration from other sources, but for antiquity especially, it is too much to expect corroboration for most points of the narrative, particularly when the narrative being tested is the most detailed or only detailed account of the events in question. Room must be left for the source in question to add to our knowledge of the period. Consider the matter of eyewitness testimony first. On the basis of biblical information, John and Matthew were Jesus' immediate disciples. Mark probably had much less direct contact with Jesus. He appears to have been young and living in Jerusalem at this time. Paul was probably older, but he says little about pre-conversion contact with Jesus. Probably had seen Jesus only once or twice in Jerusalem. Unlike the others, Luke is a Gentile, probably a native Antioch, and presumably unconverted, presumably converted during the work of Paul and Barnabas there in the 40s. He would have had the least direct contact with eyewitnesses, as the others were in Judea for 5 or more years immediately following Jesus' ministry. Yet Luke had considerable contact with Paul and Silas, stayed several days with Philip, and apparently spent 2 years in Palestine while Paul was in prison in Caesarea. All 5 writers, therefore, had considerable opportunity to make use of eyewitness testimony. Comparing these writers with classical historians, the status of John and Matthew as participants in many of the events they record is parallel to that of Pliny the Younger, Xenophon, Polybius, and Thucydides. Paul's situation, having been on both sides of the controversy, is parallel to that of Josephus during the Jewish revolt, with a notable difference that Josephus switched from the side with wealth and political power in order to save his life, while Paul endangered his life by changing to the side without these attractions. Luke and Mark are in positions comparable to Tacitus, Suetonius, and Herodotus, when the latter report on events before their time, but recent enough to have been living eyewitnesses. None of these 5 biblical writers in the position of Plutarch for most of his material, or Josephus, Suetonius, and Herodotus for their earlier material, where eyewitnesses were no longer living. Thus, the New Testament situation here is comparable to best cases among ancient historians. What about bias? It is true that the biblical writers are all Christians and see events from that perspective. This does not rule out the possibility that they were sincere and that they only reported events for which they had good evidence. Note the methodology indicated in the prologue of Luke's Gospel. Many have undertaken, this quoting, to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were entrusted to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Unquote. It is also significant that the authors report events which reflect unfavorably on themselves as well as on the apostles and early Christians in general. Only Jesus receives no unfavorable notice in agreement with the biblical picture that he is God incarnate and therefore sinless. No attempt is made, however, to remove seemingly harsh statements by Jesus or charges against him by his opponents, nor do the biblical writers seek to hide the fact that they are Christians by pretending to give an impartial account, as we see in the Jewish letter of Aristeus and the apocryphal Christian Acts of Philo. It is likewise worthy of note that Paul was not on Jesus' side during his ministry. Indeed, he was a violent and high-ranking member of the opposition. Surely Paul knew whatever could be said against Jesus and his followers. By comparison, our classical historians had their biases too. Josephus was very favorable to the Roman emperors and the Pharisees, but highly antagonistic to the Zealots who led the revolt against Rome. Tacitus was against the imperial system and longed for restoration of the Republic. Suetonius found it hard to pass off a good scandal, no matter how unlikely the story. Pliny, shocked by Roman vices, preferred to emphasize pleasant matters. Plutarch wrote his biographies to teach virtue and warn against vice. One writer characterizes him as tantalizing and treacherous to the historian. Herodotus is highly regarded for his careful work and reserve, yet he too is charged with strong religious feeling bordering superstition. Xenophon wrote the first part of his Anabasis under pseudonym. The latter part is tense and aggressive as he answers his critics. He was notably sympathetic to authoritarian regimes. Polybius blasts previous historians in Book 12 and was prejudiced against the regions of Aetolia and Boeotia. In spite of these evidences of bias, each of these secular historians is important for our understanding of events of antiquity. Each reports many events for which we have no other evidence, and they are pretty well the best of the lot. As a result, A.N. Sherwin White, classical historian at Oxford, remarks, "It is astonishing that while Greco-Roman historians have been growing in confidence, 20th century study of the gospel narrative starting from no less promising material has taken so gloomy a turn in development of form criticism that the more advanced exponents of it apparently maintain that the historical Christ is unknowable and the history of his mission cannot be written." This seems very curious. Let's now turn to four Gospels to see what events are reported as occurring during Easter week. We here summarize briefly all the events reported by two or more Gospels. Shortly before Passover, Jesus approaches Jerusalem with a crowd of pilgrims. He rides into Jerusalem on a young donkey, recalling Zechariah 9:9. As the crowds greet him with shouts of Hosanna, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord, and acclamation is King of Israel. After looking around the temple, he returns to Bethany, where he's staying. Next day, he returns to Jerusalem, cursing the burning fig tree on the way. He then casts the merchants and their animals out of the temple courts. Following day, Jesus again returns to the temple where his authority is challenged by the temple officials. Pharisees and Herodians seek to trap him with a question on Roman taxes. Sadducees pose a problem for belief in resurrection. Jesus turns each of these attacks back on his opponents and then discusses God's greatest commandment with a lawyer. Jesus ends the debate by asking the Pharisees how the Messiah can be merely David's son when he's also his Lord. This is followed by Jesus' scathing rebuke to the Pharisees for their hypocrisy. Jesus observes and approves the widow's sacrificial gift to the temple, and then he leaves the temple for the last time. On the way back to Bethany, Jesus gathers his disciples on the Mount of Olives and gives them a detailed description of the coming destruction of Jerusalem, of the temple, and his own return in glory. Sometime during this period, Judas secretly makes arrangements with the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. The next day or the following, Jesus sends some of his disciples to make preparations for their Passover meal in the upper room in Jerusalem. At the meal, Judas is shown by a signal that his betrayal has been detected, but Jesus lets him go. He then warns the remaining disciples of the dangers ahead in which they will fall away, Peter especially being singled out. The Lord's Supper is instituted, symbolizing his coming death. Finally, they leave the room and cross Kidron Valley to pray in a garden on the Mount of Olives. There, Judas and the temple soldiers find him and arrest him as the disciples flee. Jesus is taken by the Jewish leaders, tried, and early the next morning formally condemned for blasphemy by the Sanhedrin and the Jewish Supreme Court. Then he is taken before the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, who is reluctant to ratify their decision. After some stalling, the leaders apply mob pressure, and Pilate permits Jesus' condemnation as king. Jesus is crucified in a place called Golgotha between two bandits and dies that afternoon after several hours of unusual darkness. His body is claimed by a wealthy Jew named Joseph Arimathea, who buries him in his personal tomb, while women in Jesus' party look on. On the third day at dawn, a group of women come to anoint Jesus' body but find the tomb empty. That day, Jesus appears to several individuals and a group several times, and finally to the disciples of the whole. Easter week ends at this point, but the Gospels and Acts recount several other appearances of Jesus. The Apostle Paul does not give a detailed account. Well, basically, I had a brief summary after this corroboration by the Apostle Paul, make about 5 points of corroboration, some of which involving 20 or 30 items. Then corroboration by pagan sources, mention of references in pagan sources that corroborate points of the gospel accounts regarding Easter week, then corroboration by Jewish sources. I may try to sneak a little of those in either my rebuttal or the final summary if I can get a chance. I'll try and do a rebuttal for the sake of our opponent here, since he would not appreciate me sneaking in new material in the summary.
want to.
I've put up here on the board, can you hear me all right back there? The Aramaic words, Yeshua bar Yosef, that is say Joshua, the son of Joseph, as an indication of, well, a way that I have found it convenient to think of, a term that I found convenient to use as a substitute for the expression, the historical Jesus, trying to get away from the connotations of the name Jesus and trying to recognize that this was a man who was one of the Jews of the time, Joshua, the son of Joseph. Now, I have a suspicion that to a considerable extent, Professor Newman and I are going to be talking sort of past each other, because I don't view my role here as that of an opponent so much as that of a person who, on looking at the Gospels in considerable detail and reading them over and over, sees a certain amount of discrepancy and a certain amount of material that needs to be explained by further knowledge concerning the background. And I'll admit, I view the Bible as being primarily, well, consisting entirely of human documents written by human beings, that some parts of it seem to be of divine inspiration, and others, I'm sorry to say, not, such as the story of Lot and his daughters. That depends on the preconceptions of the reader to a considerable extent. But there are, it seems to me, evidences that there were factors in the situation that was present at Easter week, which either aren't mentioned or are barely hinted at in the Gospels, and which we need to take into account if we're going to understand whether we accept the matter of miracles or not. In the first place, we have to realize that the Jewish people, of course, at that time were subject to Roman occupation, and that there was really two possibilities concerning a Jew's attitude at that time. He could either accept the situation, or he could be against it. And those who were the most violently against it were the zealots. Now, these zealots were what nowadays they call freedom fighters, and they ranged everywhere from sincere, honest, extremists, activists, to apparently just plain bandits. And they were known as Canaanites, also as robbers, also as criminals or transgressors. Now, these zealots were some of them, of course, as I've suggested, of the Che Guevara or the Andreas Bader type. They were known as dagger men or sicarii, because that was one of their favorite weapons. And they were continually stirring up trouble against the Roman occupiers. There's an account in the Bible of a massacre that took place the previous year before the execution of Yeshua bar Yosef. And in this situation, the people who were in charge of the Jewish state, the high priest and the Sanhedrin, were in a very precarious position. They had, on the one hand, to try to maintain the state of Israel. On the other hand, they had to also make sure that not too much opposition surfaced, simply because the Roman occupiers might simply decide to exterminate them all. And of course, that did happen half a generation later. And therefore, Caiaphas, as he's called in the English Bible, and Annas, and the others of the Sanhedrin, had as their prime concern preserving the state. Now, there's been considerable discussion as to whether Yeshua bar Yosef had or had not been a zealot. The extreme position is taken by a man named Brandon, S.G. Brandon, in a book called Jesus and the Zealots, in which he maintains that Yeshua bar Yosef was all this time a zealot, and that all of the teachings concerning peace, all of their Irenic aspects of the Bible, were simply later interpolations put in to cover up the basic fact that Yeshua bar Yosef had been a zealot and was executed as such. That position seems, so far as I can gather, to be rejected by most scholars. There is a very good book by a man named Hengel, H-E-N-G-E-L, called Die Zeloten, The Zealots. I don't know whether there's an English translation of it or not. In any case, it's a very thorough, extensive discussion, which makes it clear that this problem of the zealots was really the major concern in the situation at that time. Now, did the authorities perceive Yeshua bar Yosef as a zealot? They probably did. And that would explain the saying that's attributed to Caipha. It is expedient that one person should perish rather than the whole nation. Because if the high priests were afraid that the Romans would take all of this uproar at the time of Yeshua bar Yosef's entry into Jerusalem as being another manifestation of zealotic fanaticism, there's no telling what they might do. Therefore, the high priests simply viewed Yeshua bar Yosef as a, at the least bad a nuisance, and at the worst as a threat, a very real threat to the continuance of Israel. And I think we have to understand that that was their motivation in trying to get him out of the way, but at the same time get him out of the way without compromising their own position. And there was a great deal of buck passing there. They wanted to have him executed, but they managed to work it so that Pilate was the one that had to take the real responsibility. And they said, and rightly, well, we have no king. This man has set himself up as a king. And essentially what they did was to threaten to report Pilate to Caesar, saying, if anyone sets himself up as a king and you let him go, you're not a friend to Caesar. Therefore, Pilate, as it were, was in a bind. They had him over a barrel. If he didn't order Yeshua bar Yosef's execution, then they could report him to Rome and have him put in a very bad position with respect to the Roman emperor. Now, that I think also explains why the crowd shouted for the release of Bar Abba. Incidentally, if I'm not mistaken, I have read that Barabbas, as he's given in the Greek, that his actual given name was also Yeshua, that he was Yeshua bar Abba, Joshua, the son of the father. He was a zealot, no question. He was in prison, condemned to death for sedition and murder. He had caused a riot. And it'd be quite understandable that the crowd who had hoped when Yeshua bar Yosef came into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday and was acclaimed, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, that the people had hoped that he would lead them in war against the Romans. And he didn't do it. And I can just imagine people getting terribly disappointed by Wednesday or Thursday of that same week and falling away from him and wanting to have the real zealot released and saying, well, we don't want this guy. This chap has pooed out on us. Whereas on the other hand, Yeshua Barabbas will be a much better leader against the Romans. And that brings, of course, the question of what's usually referred to as Judas or Yehuda Iscariot. Why did he go to the high priests? There have been all kinds of explanations suggested for that. Among other things, that he was angry because of the matter of the oil that Miriam of Magdala poured over Yeshua Bar Yosef's head. You remember he said this money, this could have been sold and the money given to the poor. Others have suggested that perhaps he was trying to force Yeshua Bar Yosef's hand and force him to declare himself as an activist leader. Another possibility, which I've suggested in that article, that notorious article of a year ago, that possibly, at least, it may not have been anything resembling a betrayal. That Yeshua Bar Yosef may possibly have said to Yehuda Iscariot, go and make an arrangement with the priests, and may have said, or at least thought to himself, we don't know how much he discussed it with anybody, seeing that he was losing credit with the people, wanted to come to some kind of arrangement with the high priests. We don't know what. We don't know whether it was that he wanted to get them to acknowledge his higher authority, or whether he may have wanted, on the other hand, to be taken in some sort of protective custody, but that he may have told Yehuda Iscariot to go and make an arrangement with them, which would explain, among other things, his saying, go and do your errand quickly, without, of course, the others knowing quite what that errand was. And it states specifically that in the Gospel of John, if I remember correctly, that they didn't understand what he was driving at the time. I think that Yeshua Bar Yosef realized that he was in a very ticklish and precarious position. And there's an interesting passage in Luke, which is in general, sort of glossed over. I'll read you the portion of the chapter 22 of Luke, which is relevant here. It's just after he has said to Peter, I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me. And then starting in verse 35, and he said unto them, when I sent you without purse and scrip and shoes, lacked ye anything? And they said, no. Then said he unto them, but now he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say unto you, that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me. And he, quote, and he was reckoned among the transgressors, end quote. For the things concerning me have an end. And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said unto them, it is enough. Well, so far as I can gather, most commentators seem to have been very worried about that passage. And most of them sort of leave it out of consideration, or they try to explain it allegorically, the two swords meaning perhaps the power of the earth and heaven, or something of that kind. On the other hand, if you look at it in this light, I think perhaps it makes more sense. Namely, that Yeshua Bar Yosef realized that he was in a very bad spot, and he didn't know whether he was going to be taken into custody, perhaps that he might have the worst happen to him. And of course he was terribly anguished about that and prayed that the cup might be taken from him. But suppose that he was thinking, well, if I'm going to be captured, it's better for me to be captured as a transgressor. He should be reckoned among the transgressors, among the criminals. Well, that was one of the terms that was applied to the zealots. And is it not possible that he thought, well, they must at least find some kind of weapons among my group so that they will consider that I was actually a zealot. And this may have been devised to perhaps reacquire a bit of credit among the general populace and the followers of the zealots. That's a possibility. I think that at least gives some explanation for this rather enigmatic passage. Now, there's the other question, which of course comes up particularly on Good Friday, naturally. To what extent was it accurate, was the interpretation, of course the Gospels all agree on this, that Yeshua Bar Yosef did die and did get resurrected in the flesh. Now, I think it's generally known that various Jewish critics have objected and said, well, he didn't really die, that he was still alive when he was taken down from the cross. Now, frankly, so far as I can gather, and I've consulted with some biologist friends on this, the evidence seems rather doubtful. That is to say, there are certain considerations which make me at any rate, wonder, is it possible, perhaps, that he didn't actually die? In the first place, the matter of the short time. It was only 6 hours. Now, I understand, again, I'm not a specialist in this field, but I've read here and there, and I understand from what I've read about what normally happened when people were crucified, that they normally took anywhere from 24 to 48 to 72 hours to die. It was terribly, terribly long drawn out. That was why first the Carthaginians and then the Romans used that method so as to make them suffer just as long as possible. And 6 hours was a pretty short time. Now, one explanation for that has been that he was given a pretty bad beating up before he was taken up to Golgotha. Now, beating up was given to him specifically so that he would die quicker. That may well be, it may not be. There's also the problem of the coagulation of the blood. Of course, we are told that when he was poked with the lance, that blood and water came out. Now, what do they mean by blood and water? We're not told how long it was after he is said to have given up the ghost. How long after that was it that the soldier poked him with the lance? Yet that seems to be, excuse the pun, a rather crucial element in the discussion. That is to say, I'm told by my biologist friends that it takes about an hour for the blood in a corpse to coagulate. After that, the most that you'll get out if you poke somebody would be a few drops of blood or serum. And that's the most. We don't know whether it was a few drops or whether it came out in larger quantities. But if it came out in larger quantities, then there's a very definite possibility, at least, that he wasn't dead. And of course, he was buried in a cave. in the sepulcher that had been hewn out of the rock. And there is always, and the Jewish commentators, of course, make considerable of this, that you don't know what there may have been in the way of a back entrance. Some of them also suggested that the soldiers on guard may have been bribed. We don't know one way or the other. But it would be at least possible that if he was not dead, that in one way or another, they sneaked him out of there. We also don't know how severe were the wounds through his hands and his feet. The nails that were stuck through, how thick were they? Were they the size of our railroad spikes? That's what people tend to think of them as, I think. Or were they thinner? Don't know. We do know that his legs were not broken. They broke the legs of the other two chaps, who incidentally were qualified in the Bible accounts as robbers. Robbers? Perhaps, were they zealots? If so, that would lend even more importance to their remarks. We are getting what we deserve, but he hasn't done anything. Now, if they were zealots, that would be particularly significant. In any case, since we don't know what actual, how much actual damage was done to his hands and feet, that means we don't know how long, now just assuming for the purpose of the discussion that he wasn't dead, how long would it take him to recover from those? And how long would it be necessary for him to be able to walk again, to be able to do things with his hands? Now, of course, he appeared to the disciples and to others in the flesh. It's quite, that, of course, is perfectly consonant with the possibility that he actually didn't die. And sure, he appeared in the flesh. And sure, Thomas was able to poke his finger in the wound in the side, and particularly if it was ulcerated. And then, of course, if you assume that, then, well, we don't know what happened afterwards. It's perfectly possible that he might have had visions that he had been taken up to heaven, and that he considered he had. But we don't know, as I say, what happened afterwards. That he might have simply been too badly injured and have died soon after. Or, excuse the colloquialism, he may have decided that being a messiah really wasn't his bag after all, and that he may have just gone off and lived somewhere else. Well, we just don't know. That's the case where you can actually say the Lord only knows. But in this particular matter, right at present, I'm, after reading and rereading and rereading the Bible account, inclined to be, well, skeptical. It seems to me there's perhaps a 50-50 possibility that he may not actually have died. Now, I'm not, therefore, as I say, I don't think that this is to be taken as a specific negative. I'm afraid I'm returning to the position that my chemist father and my historian mother had of being simply agnostic. I just don't know, and I'm not sure that there are any ways of knowing short. And Dr. Newman is absolutely right, of course, in saying, well, all right, you have to accept these things as miracles, and you have to be willing to accept the possibility. And I'll admit, so far as my own individual history is concerned, I passed through a period in which I was willing to accept the biblical accounts as being quite accurate, and I think my moment of most greatest persuasion was when I was singing in the St. Matthew Passion 7 years ago, and I've been deconvinced, starting when I sang in the St. John Passion by Mr. Bach. But I'll simply conclude by saying that I'm not, like Mephistopheles, the spirit which is always denying, always negating, but, well, I'm just a little bit skeptical, that's all.
All right, we have a 10-minute break. I'll set the buzzer for 10 minutes, and afterwards we'll have a 10-minute discussion session where each will get to give a 10-minute presentation and then the questions.